Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rates and Lanes with your hosts, Rico Muhammad and Chuck Snow.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, the Rates and Lanes podcast coming to you live on a Tuesday evening. We are primed and ready to go tonight. If you have questions, we have our resident legal expert that will be joining us this evening for the podcast, Mr. Hank Seaton. So if you got questions, we don't always want to take up the show and just disseminate information. We don't have a problem with doing that. But we also welcome your call of participation. You know, a conversation is much better when we got more participation that contributes. So I get a lot of people a lot of times that send me questions or that want to ask questions, and it's okay. It's okay. There's no such thing as this is a safe place for us. There's no such thing as a stupid question. There's no such thing as a dumb question. So don't feel that way. Just press number one. It's just like having a regular little old conversation. Don't get intimidated and think that it's a much bigger deal than what it is. We welcome your interaction and your being said. Without any further ado, let's jump over into the trend lines information for this week. We have diesel fuel that is steadily creeping back, just slowly kind of creeping up, have jumped up by 0.4 percentage points. So we're showing the national average of diesel fuel right now at $2.44 per gallon. Load post outpaced truck post on the DAT1 load board networks last week as capacity tightened ahead of the annual road check inspection blitz that began the week that pushed prices higher on many high traffic lanes. But let's take a look and see how things were performing on the spot market previous week, starting off with dry vans up in the northeastern portion of the United States. We're showing an outbound spot market average for dry vans at $156 out of the Northeast. Moving down to the mid-Atlantic and southeastern states, we show an outbound spot market rate for dry vans at $193. Coming out of the Midwest, we're showing an outbound spot market rate for dry vans at $2 even per mile on average. Moving down to the south central region of the United States, outbound spot market rates for dry vans are at $191. And coming out of the West Coast, we're showing outbound spot market rate for dry vans at $204. Moving along, jumping over into the flatbed segment coming out of the northeastern portion of the United States, which are on an outbound spot market rate for flatbeds at $190. Moving down to the mid-Atlantic and southeastern states, we're showing an outbound spot market rate for flatbeds at $2.30 per mile. Coming out of the Midwest, we're showing an average outbound spot market rate for flatbeds at $2.22. Down in the south central region of the United States, an outbound spot market rate for flatbeds at $2.13. And wrapping up, coming out of the West Coast, we're showing an average for flatbeds at $1.98. And moving over to the final segment, the reefer or temperature control portion of the report, showing an outbound spot market rate at $1.70 coming out of the Northeast on average. The average outbound spot market coming out of the mid-Atlantic and southeastern states, $2.14 per mile. Coming out of the Midwest, we're showing an outbound average for reefers at $2.19 is the average coming out of the south central region of the United States. And coming out of the West Coast, showing a very strong $2.42 per mile on average on the outbound spot market rate for reefers. And with that being said, let me welcome my co-host, Mr. Chuck Snow, to the show. Chuck, good evening. How are you?
We're doing well. How are you, Rico?
Oh man, I tell you, I'm almost wanting to say if it got any better, I couldn't stand it. But I'll take a little bit more before I get to that point.
Yeah, bite your tongue. You know, we're starting to see things up in Canada open up a bit. You know, in parts of the country, life is returning to normal. We are in the Maritime provinces, which is to the east. They've kind of drawn a fence around their area, and they only want people from that region. And there's four provinces that make up our Maritime provinces, and they're allowed and they're welcoming tourism from their own region, but they don't want people from the rest of Canada going in there. And then slowly but surely, the other provinces are all opening up. Ontario and Quebec are a little bit slower, especially Ontario, because we've had some outbreaks here. And they're erring on the side of caution here. And hopefully they're doing the right thing. It seems they are. And, you know, bit by bit, you know, life is starting to get back to our new normalcy. And we don't know what that's quite going to look like yet.
Yeah, it's been kind of crazy, topsy-turvy here. But I never want to keep this man waiting when we have him on the show. It's always an education. And we definitely appreciate him for taking time out of his schedule to come on and join us at least once a month. But here lately, we've been kind of getting the daily double and getting them every now and again to come in and chime in on some other things. But with all that being said, our resident legal expert, Mr. Hank Seaton. Good evening, Hank. How are you?
Good night, Rico and Chuck. How are you guys doing?
We're doing great.
Thanks for coming on board.
How
about things over there at the Seaton household?
Well, we're hunkered down. The rain is gone, but it's going to be hot here. We're in the mid-90s, and, you know, working in the yard is a challenge. But other than that, life is busy, and we're trying to figure out what's going to happen tomorrow. We're looking at canceling a trade show set for February of next year for fear that people won't be able to fly to Key West to enjoy it. So, you know, our future's unclear, isn't it, guys?
Wow.
Yeah, it's the virus has really, here in the States, Chuck, it is kind of, I'm not even going to say a second wave, because we didn't really get out of the first wave, and it's kind of taken back off and seems to be no end in sight. And Florida is leading the charge with record number of cases being reported. They had a couple of days in a row where they had record numbers of cases being reported in Florida. So, yeah, we're still in a lot of places. The talk that I'm hearing and that you're seeing on the news is that a lot of places are still talking about maybe going back, and maybe we open up too quickly and shutting back down again. And so I'm not sure exactly. I'm trying to read the tea leaves on all of this and see how is this going to affect our industry, and the different things that we supply, and to see how this thing kind of shakes out. But it's quite a quagmire down on this end.
Yeah, it sounds it. You know, we were talking to, and he's a good friend of yours too, Hank. Tommy Rook last week was on our show, and we were talking about the possibility of a food shortage, and I think that it really could happen. You know, when you think of the migrant labor that's used in both our countries to pick our fresh fruits and vegetables. And I know up here in Canada, we've had several incidents with these people becoming ill with COVID, and you know, one operation in Leamington was shut right down by the federal government. Allegedly, they shut their water off, so they would have to stop and let their employees get back.
Well, down here, we had that real problem with fresh beef and pork. Right. You know, the virus spreads very quickly in those slaughterhouses where there's no such thing as social discipline.
Right.
You know, they close down a couple of big slaughterhouses, and all of a sudden the cost of beef goes through the roof, and everybody's eating pork butts if they can find them. So we've already been through that, and the replication for the motor carrier industry is there's this old thing, and I don't know whether I should say it on the radio. It's the 7 P's, which is prior proper planning prevents piss poor performance. And you know, I think we all want to kind of plan. We all kind of want to plan for the future, but there's no planning possible when COVID is the wild card. What stock market do you play? You know, do you hide it in a can in your yard? I don't think there's anybody that can predict it, but all of the models are changing. The distribution model is changing. People that it can afford it are putting it all in technology, thinking that the truckload market is going to change appreciably. And, you know, a change of administration down here can really play havoc with the independent contractor model. So how do you plan now? Some industries have been going full bore since March, April, and May, and have been relatively unaffected. And some of those truckers are not people you thought would have done well.
Yeah. But, you know, other things, you know, I'm seeing signs of life, places where I really didn't expect to see them. And where we live in this region, there's a Honda assembly plant about 40 miles north of us, and there's a lot of trucks that run up and down the highway in front of our farm, and I see those trucks go by all the time. And then there's a bunch of stamping plants to the south of us and to the northwest of us that make components. And my wife and I were out for a little drive last night after dinner, and I was surprised how many automotive trucks I saw, and these are trucks carrying auto parts, going last night alone. And I do see them running up and down our roadway, where in March and April and May, I didn't see one. And then talking to people that have never owned a car before, they're buying cars because they don't want to take public transit. So, you know, there are some resurgence in some industries where we thought they were, you know, we thought they were probably gone, and the automotive industry being one of them. You know, I personally wrote that one off. I think I was wrong. I think maybe it's going to hold its own.
One of the little groups I work with is the Auto Haulers Association. And,
right.
You know, they've had some real frowns on their face because, you know, it looks like most of the big auto is looking at cutbacks, and, you know, they're just barely kiltering along. And I guess it to some extent depends on how far up the supply chain you are and how much they're able or willing to inventory. But, you know, I haven't heard anybody saying happy days are here in the auto industry.
No.
So maybe it's just, a blip that Honda's going. But we've got, you know, a Nissan plant down here and a VW plant. And so we kind of look at them as maybe bellwethers. And GM is laying off people permanently down at the Saturn plant. So I don't know. I keep watching the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times to try to figure out what's happening, but I can't tell it. I don't really know. I think for a small carrier, you would caution, get as much government money as you can, and don't overextend yourself in terms of credit, to some guy who may go out on you. One of the things that that we're doing, I'd love to have feedback from y'all's audience, is starting to look at how to do risk management when it comes to extending credit, because we're seeing household names go out of business, and the motor carriers will be the last one to be paid. You know, you got J.C. Penney was kind of a dead man walking, but who thought that Neiman Marcus would go out? And you know, every day it seems like you're picking up the newspaper and seeing somebody else take advantage of bankruptcy. Particularly tough if you're the second tier sitting under a broker, and the broker says you've only got recourse to him, and he goes out. You can't get blood out of a turnip if he's misapplied the money. So, you know, it's all trucking is the only industry that's got probably less than a 5% margin where somebody will give a guy 45, 60, or 90 days to pay and go to a factor and pay 3 or 4% for the privilege of doing that. That just doesn't make good sense. Not when the law says basically cash and carry, you're supposed to pay it in 15 days.
You know, it's really tough out there. And one of the things that, you know, I've been talking to a lot of carriers and that have faced that problem. And, you know, most of the factoring deals are written in such a way, for whatever reason, they're not able to collect. Your customer goes bankrupt. And you've been forwarded the money, you have to pay that back.
And the other thing about factoring is they usually keep 20% of your money in the case that happens. I think if anybody on the line is using a commercial factor, I've got a chapter in our book about that. Good factors are on your side when it comes to giving credit limits to shippers. They're the early warning system for who's in problem. But there are people who will do non-recourse buying. And, you know, that's one way to, you know, if you got somebody big that you're worried about, you might just go ahead and if you're factoring, paid a little bit extra for non-recourse, because you don't
do
want to get hung with half a million dollars.
The non-recourse, the problem with it is, number one, you pay a lot more for it, which is fine. There's one company out there, and I'll say their name, but they're a fine company. I've known them for many years, called Riviera. And if I'm not mistaken, that's the only way they do it. But on the other side, they will check clients out very carefully before they do a deal. So they don't buy a lot of bad paper because they're doing their due diligence. But even doing due diligence, I have to tell you, we had one yesterday. You gentlemen would be very interested in this. I got a call from my credit department. A new sales guy came on, and he had an account, and it didn't look very good. And we ran it through two separate credit agencies, and I'll say their names. We one of them is Dun & Bradstreet, and the other one was
go ahead. Who else?
And the other one was the was Lena's company that was on a couple weeks ago. And what was really strange was one of them said their credit was horrible. And the other credit one said, well, their credit wasn't stellar, but it was certainly good. So who the heck do you believe? Like, what, you know, what KPIs are they using? How do you, you know, and this is the same information that the other one where Lena works is Ansonia Credit. But how do factoring companies make good decisions? How do you, even if you sign up, you subscribe to these companies, how do you make good decisions when the difference is night and day between two credit bureaus? What's the truth?
Chuck, you are just playing into something that I ran into today. and this may be a suggestion for a future show. One of the trade associations I represent, before they let somebody in, checks out their bona fides to be sure that they pay their bills and they've got a stellar credit. Well, they use one of the credit agencies that scores people. And
right.
So they were presenting somebody today who's a personal client. And they said, well, using our score indicia, they've dropped 4 points and we don't think we can admit them. And I came off the wall and I said, look, I don't want you to make a bad credit decision, but they've been a client for 4 years and I think they're up straight. Well, somebody said, but we use this scoring mechanism. And then I said, well, now look, you know, that scoring mechanism is probably like SMS methodology. You got to show to me that it's a fair indication. I said, you know, they may have had one disgruntled carrier report them and they dipped 4 points and you're going to bar them from membership. Years ago, I had a little bit of an ownership interest in an outfit called CompuNet. You guys may remember it. They published a deadbeat list and they listed every month who had reported people from being beyond credit terms. And
right.
If you got that and you had an interest and you saw that 4 people had reported them, you picked up the call and said, what's the story? And then made your own decision. You didn't wait on some damn scoring mechanism. Well, I told these people, look, you know, at least you ought to ask a reporting service based upon how many samplings did you make and who reported them, because those reporting services don't verify the accuracy of the claim.
Exactly.
And
hallelujah.
And the scoring methodology may very well be that they're arguing over detention bill. So
exactly.
I think that anybody who relies on that is absolutely stupid. Well, what I did when I got through, I picked up the phone and called a guy who is a wonderful factor. He's been a client for years. Their idea is that they want to keep their client happy, because if they're prosperous, you know, there won't be any churn. And he said, let me have a hold of them. So while I was on the phone, he checked it with D&B and everybody else and reported the number of bills that they had bought over the past years. And he said, I'll get you an up-to-date report, Hank, but anybody who's fool enough, and he went through a list. And, you know, I can tell you that I got respect for Orange Commercial Credit. And then
great
I could
company.
Give you some others. Yeah, I got some others that, you know, I think don't do a very hot job. And anybody who's sitting here looking at a Paydex score off of Dun & Bradstreet is missing it, because how people pay their trucking services may be entirely different from how Dun & Bradstreet strips it, because what they do is they get big companies to give them their data dump. And it doesn't have a damn thing to do with the transportation sector. So if somebody's going out of business, he's going to pay his vital merchants first, and he's going to drag his motor carriers. So you're concerned about how they're paying motor carriers, not D&B scores.
Exactly. And, yeah, you know, I'll tell you a fast, funny story before we go on. Way, way back when I first started my first real trucking company, that wasn't when I was an owner-operator, it was 42 years ago. I started a little gypsy company upstairs of the family's flower shop, and I called it Snow and Sons, and I needed credit. And I told Dun & Bradstreet that my grandfather founded it. I had just started the company, and you know what? I ended up with, like, when I hit the ground running, I had great credit. Because you know, I was third generation, which wasn't true. I you know, 42 years ago, you know, later I can tell you I lied. But I needed, you know, the only way I was going to get credit from Hertz and Ryder and Gilflex and a whole bunch of other ones.
Well,
so
I'll
I
tell
hope
you,
they
I'll
check
tell
better
you.
Now.
I'll tell you this, funny Graham. When CompuNet got started, it was just when truckload service was beginning to come out in the late 80s. And,
yep.
You know, they published this deadbeat list. And I was the one that called the balls and strikes on whether or not to publish it. So I think everybody knows who Alan Lund is. I think they're a great company. But they had lots of loads, so they had lots of people that would turn them in. And every time they'd get reported, old Mr. Lund would call me and say, "Hank, I got to explain this." And nine times out of ten, the issue was his payment terms were 30 days after receipt of the documents, and the carrier carried the bills of lading around his truck until he got home and didn't send them in to 2 weeks late and then thought he's going to get paid in 15 days. So, you know, we had that kind of service built into CompuNet so that people's reputation wouldn't get sullied by simply publishing mistakes. And, you know, I think you really owe it to the broker to, if he's been reported. I mean, look, if you can tell there's a run on the bank and 42 people have reported him and he owes $15,000, don't bother. But otherwise, if he's got some kind of paydex score, you need to figure out who's reported him and why.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, a lot of times I can tell you from running a brokerage, if we get into situations, it's not just the mirage and attention. We have freight claims. You know, what happens when we give somebody a load of berries and their reefer breaks and they don't have insurance, a reefer breakdown insurance, and they cook a $70,000 load of berries of some sort. You know, that we're not paying them till we get this thing settled because we know they don't have the wherewithal. It's a one truck operator. So, you know, that's when any brokerage house, especially ones that are handling produce, are vulnerable to these credit scores. And, you know, a lot of the brokerage houses they're turning away from either produce or other ones that are doing produce don't want to deal with new carriers or one truck. It's not worth it to them.
Well, Chuck, you know that the rules for produce are completely different from the broker rules for regulated freight.
Yeah.
The shipper has always expected the produce broker to make good on the claims, and because of the insurance, I'm sure that my friend Tommy talked about it, is you can't get anybody that'll cover reject it, crush it, and dump it.
Basically,
the saving day used to be that the produce broker made enough of an upcharge to eat a few loads, but that's still the Wild West, and it's even been made more difficult because of FSMA and the misinterpretation that, you know, if you're off 2 degrees, perfectly good produce has to be dumped.
Oh, yeah, it is, and that's why in the United States, you do not see a lot of very large produce trucking companies. It's just it's very difficult now to run a produce company. There's too many variables. Things can happen. Now, with technology, there may be, in the next couple of years, a resurgence back into it. And, you know, there may be some large money go back into buying some smaller produce trucking companies and merging them together because the technology is there where you can control the reefers remotely. You can keep an eye on them. You can keep an eye on your driver. It's just, I think things are heading that way. Otherwise, we won't get our produce anymore.
Well, I'm not necessarily trying to solicit people who have got this problem. But FSMA, basically, with the recordable reefer, lets a motor carrier demonstrate that if the crap was frozen, it was frozen even before or after it was put on the truck. Because with your own internal reefer, you can demonstrate that the fact they claim that it pulped hot at the other end was because you weren't allowed on the dock to look at it. It was loaded hot out of the valley. All of that is a very sophisticated analysis that most people don't want to fool with. So the big produce brokers just try to take it out of the carrier's hide, and the insurer will never pay it because they want, you know, they want to contest it, particularly with reefer breakdown, because they say, well, we don't care what the temp shows. You got to prove that the reefer physically broke down. And so the poor carrier gets stuck in the middle, and I can't tell you how much I'm trying to push back on the produce broker who says, well, all we know is it was delivered hot. I say, well, you're going to have to overcome my records because my records show, and I got an expert that will testify that whatever temperature you gave it to me, we maintained in transit. And, you know, that takes a scientist who understands thermodynamics to explain it. It really does.
You've got to
understand that reefer, based upon the mileage, isn't going to affect the core temperature of what's involved.
No. And you know, a lot of people don't realize that what reefers do is they maintain temperature. They will not cool. They don't cool anything. And the other thing that I want our listeners that don't realize this, you've got to be able to pulp freight. If you don't, you're opening up. And Hank is an experienced transportation lawyer. I'm sure you can vouch for this. The danger is if you go into a situation to load a load of produce and they don't let you on the dock, this becomes very dangerous for the carrier because you have no idea what they're giving you. And you're going to... In the end, you may get away with it, but it's going to hurt you in the end, you know, unless you can hire somebody like Hank to defend you. And Hank does a great job. He's gotten me out of some hot water in my life, and I have great respect
for him. Let me tell anybody that's on the line, just remember this. If your name is Rico Mohammed and you didn't get a chance to pulp that because they wouldn't let you on your dock, when you sign that delivery receipt, you're SL&C Muhammad. That stands for shipper, load, and count. Because there is a statute that says that if you put shipper, load, and count or words of similar import, you're not verifying the temperature or the count of the product. And I can't tell you how many times I get involved in a lawsuit where it's a three-dropper, and when they get to the final drop, it's a couple of cases short, you know, and the guy never even counted it to begin with, or the warehouseman put the bad stuff in the nose. You know, if you I think that it's I understand what Chuck's saying about pulping it, but you know, a random pulp doesn't necessarily show what's hidden in the center of the skin. I think everything. Really, with the cost of transportation, ought to be SLC. And if you can show you maintain the temperature in transit and the seal was intact when you got there, you ought to be home free when it comes to a temperature claim or a shortage claim. But that's not the way the contracts work.
No, and that's not the way the world works because, first of all, an awful lot of these sheds will, especially this time of year when it's 100 degrees, it's very expensive to cool that produce. So it is imperative for that shed to get that stuff out of there as quickly as they can so they can bring in more. And it costs them a lot of money to cool it down for transportation. So if they can cut corners by giving you hot freight, they make more money. And if you think
not only that, but Kroger and those boys now place their orders late and want it on Monday morning, so the migrant hadn't even got it picked before it needs to get on the truck, so there's no pre-cooling. So, you know,
yeah.
you've got core temperatures 100. They tell you to set it on continuous run. You go all the way across the country and not affect the temperature of the beans.
Right, and as a matter of fact, you'll have a block of ice by the nose of your trailer because the trailer doesn't know what to do. It's sucking all that humidity out of that hot product. So for our listeners that are thinking of getting into the refrigerated business or have just gotten into it, you really need to be reconnaissance of the risks. Listen, there are a lot of people who do very well hauling produce. They're true experts. but you need to learn what you're doing. It's a dangerous, dangerous game. And, you know, anybody that's been doing it for any length of time can tell you that if you're not real careful, you will get burned. You know, almost years and years ago, it almost happened to us. I had sent a driver down to New York or New Jersey, and he had picked up a load of bananas off the pier. And he said to the guy loading him, "What temperature?" And the guy said, 39 degrees. And when the driver got up to Ontario, the receiver said, "How was your trip?" He said, "It was fine." He said, "What temperature you got that thing set to?" And he said, the driver said, "Like the guy told me, 39 degrees. The next thing, I had a phone call. The guy said, "Hey, Snow, you like banana bread?" I said, "I love it." He goes, "Well, start baking, buddy. You just bought 42,000 pounds or whatever it was of bananas." And I remember driving over to Machino Banana, sweating. I was just like freaking because I had been in business for about 3 weeks at this point. And we got there. Talk about having a horseshoe up my rear end. The thermostat on the reefer was broken. It didn't work right. And it was running at 14 degrees or 15 degrees warmer than it was set. So they came in at 54 degrees, which is the optimum temperature. They took it clean. I helped unload it because in those days it was hand bomb up here. I helped them unload it and said to the driver, "Take this reefer back and we're out of the reefer business." And didn't touch reefers for many years after that.
Well, listen, I got one for telling tales that beats that. I had a client to deliver a load of some kind of exotic thing to New York City, and he mess set his reefer on Fahrenheit, and it's supposed to be on centigrade.
Oh yeah.
So by the time he got there, the load was totally rejected, My client decided he would salvage the stuff because it didn't look all that bad, against the advice of the Asians that were buying the stuff. Well, all of a sudden, all people all over New York City started getting bad tofu. And so when I called up the Wall Street lawyer we were selling the bad tofu to, he said, "Mr. Seaton, come on to New York. Everybody knows that bad tofu can't be sold on the open market." And, you know, that was just clearly a case. It was a big company. It's one of the 15 largest truckload carriers in the country. That just proves it's kind of hard to get a Southern boy responsible for setting temperature on tofu. But it was just a question of the reefer temperature. And, you know, we thought, well, hell, it's got a salvage value. It doesn't smell bad. Let's cut a deal in Chinatown. It didn't quite work.
You know what, we've had, and that's something I need to warn our listeners, we're dealing with, in our world today, we are dealing with three separate countries, and it's just, you don't know where things start and where they end. We're dealing with Mexico, United States, and Canada. United States still works in Fahrenheit. Canada and I believe Mexico are both using Celsius. They're on the metric system. And you need to double check when somebody says a temperature because you don't know where the shipping instructions occurred. We had picked up some freight in, I think it was California, but Hank, I think you were involved in that one. It was one of my many. And where a carrier picked up a load and he froze it. And it was, the instructions were in, we had given the carrier instructions in Fahrenheit, and on the bill lading it was in Celsius, and the driver didn't know what, and he took the Celsius temperature and he put it into Fahrenheit or vice versa, and we had a freight claim. So, and that was freight that originated in China or in Japan, and it was some sort of orchid plants. So you really need to know what you're hauling and make sure that when they tell you a temperature, it's ascertain whether it's Fahrenheit or Celsius, or you can get into a lot of trouble because you are dealing with three different countries.
If I were able to dictate the terms and conditions for FSMA governed product, I would say that it's the job of the consignor to check the Thermo King and be sure it's properly set at the correct temperature and whether continuous run or intermediate. So put the burden on the consignor to verify the setting before you get off the property, because you know sometimes you get a through bill and it is in Celsius, and yeah. You know, just educating the average truck driver, this is their first rodeo on something coming in from the Orient or Flowers or something. It's a very simple thing to make. A simple mistake.
Well, you know, good point. And you know, Hank, I've seen some really good shippers that ship frozen and refrigerated product and even ambient that actually they do come out and they verify two things. Number one, they verify that the reefer, well, they verify three things. The reefer's running, number one. Number two, they verify the temperature that it's set at and that it's running at. And number three, when you leave, they verify that the seal is on the load. Because there's an old trick that some guys will do. They'll have room for a couple skids on the back end. And
kill a fat hog and put something on the back.
Yeah, people have been doing that ever since I knew. That pays your fuel if you're smart. Just don't get caught and do it, and use your brains. I'm not saying to do it. I'm just saying there are people that do that and are successful at it. But you got to be real careful because you can buy a load of produce.
We probably ought to change the topic because we probably only got one out of every 10 that even hauls produce. But the issue that I see that just bothers the hell out of me is when they have a mixed load. You got one reefer, no bulkhead, and they want it delivered at three or four different settings. you're just a fool to take that load.
Yeah. I was sitting here looking, Hank, I was sitting here looking at the email that you send out, the regulatory and legislative update, and I was going through a couple of things on there. I don't know if you want to expound upon a little bit more, but you
sure.
know they Congress did extend the PPP through August 8th, but I'm not sure if there's any more money left or not.
There is money left. I think some people have been guilted in returning it. I don't know how much is left. The crazy government is now on the fifth revision of the third interim rule. So it's still a target in terms of how to get forgiveness, but it seems as though they're loosening it up, particularly for small people as you go. So I think the advice that Madeline and that great guest you had on last week gave is still true, which is if you haven't filed, you ought to, because God knows everybody else has. I guess you have seen the list of the trucking companies that filed and got millions of dollars. Law firms got it too. So did accountants and people that didn't really need it. It's still time for us to get in line. The time for forgiveness has been extended. I think that what we're going to see is this COVID thing isn't going to go away this month or next. So there's going to be a need, and anything, if you file late, you may get more. The forgiveness period is being extended.
I'm hearing rumors. Nothing concrete, nothing solid. But there are some murmurings that even a possibility that the EIDL loans may even be up for forgiveness. I'm hearing some rumbling that there's a possibility that they might slide the all of the EIDL loans in there for forgiveness as well. But like I said, there's nothing as of right now. It's still a loan, but I'm hearing rumblings that it's a possibility that it could it could get slated in for forgiveness.
Yeah, I would hope so. The only thing that's going on, and I guess everybody saw it, the national debt because of all this giveaway got to $3 trillion or something. So at some point, you know, some fiscal conservatives are going to come in and say, well, you know, the feather in the cap for all the money we gave away hadn't really impressed Main Street because those guys are still bankrupt. I hope that there'll be at least an effort to get it more focused so people that, you know, have one or two trucks can use Schedule C and get some money. You know, it was entirely when people were saying you're going to get 2.5 months of stimulus, that was thinking that we're going to get this thing conquered in, you know, by mid-June. And I think the repercussions of it to Main Street may very well be felt for God knows how long. How a dysfunctional Congress comes up with that, I don't know. I just know that it's a whole lot easier to file the application and get a grant now than it was when it first came out. And, you know, the old story about move aside puppy, let the big dog drink. So the big dogs have drunk. And so now at least the banks seem to be more willing to do it. And I think the application of anything's gotten easier. And I think that was really shown by the guest you had on that, had been able to effectively do it.
Well, that was definitely when I heard when they opened everything back up, I made sure that I jumped in line immediately to get on board because you just don't know what kind of turn that any of this stuff was going to take, and it's better to have it sitting in your bank account where you've already gotten it and you've been approved and you got it sitting in your bank account versus coming in on the backside now and hoping that enough money gets returned to where you can get a decent amount to maybe help yourself out.
Well, all those people that got the money in their pocket don't have little or no fear of it being clawed back. But it seems like there's a fist fight going on between Treasury and SBA in terms of the fact that somebody thinks that you can make a loan, announce a federal statute, and then change the terms and conditions by horseback. And that leads to really a messy situation. It's kind of outrageous that the SBA, who has traditionally been the friend of small businesses, has had to administer a program that's been anything but.
Yeah. Yeah, they kind of stuck their foot in the mouth with it. First was a $10,000 grant, and then the $1,000 per employee. I think that a couple people got some lawsuits against them for that right now.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people are thinking about suing the banks. Wells Fargo, Bank of America, all these other people who misled people about their qualifications to get the loan and said they were too busy dealing with preferred customers to handle it. There are some people that are really upset about it.
Are these class action lawsuits?
Well, that's from the point of view of my brethren at Plaintiffs Bar, that's where the money is. You know, find a couple of disgruntled out of business small businesses who banked it at BOA and went to them and said, hey, file this for me, and we're told we're too busy to do it. When the result is it was easier to process a loan for somebody big that would pay them millions of dollars than it was to handle the little small business. And, you know, the real criminal thing is it was supposed to be available to people who employed, 250 or less. There was parameters to see that it went to small businesses. And all of these guys that got it were had affiliated companies that when you pyramided it,
right,
you know, they got gazillion dollars, and they really were, you know, might have had 2,000 employees just separated into different shells. Well, that don't pass the smell test, really.
So what will happen with those conglomerates? Will they have to give, like, will they have, if it is proven that they had 2,000 employees under 11 or 12 different companies, will they have to return that money eventually?
Well, one company
that I
heard about on the news that got a nice little chunk of money and said that we ain't giving it back was Planned Parenthood.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Catholic Church got $55 million. Now, they may have needed it, but they certainly had more than 2,500 employees. So, I mean, you know, it really is all over the lot. Mnuchin said he wasn't going to fool with anybody that got less than $2 million, but people that got over that might get looked at. So, you know, they're giving away so much money, they don't know how to really rein it in. And most people certainly anybody that got six figures or less probably doesn't come under a lot of scrutiny. They just need to be sure that they file for their forgiveness and use their funds as they're required to. The problem about using the funds is as long as you segregate the funds and pay it in lieu of salary to people that are otherwise working, you can probably have it forgiven and their work product falls to the bottom line in terms of profit. So, you know,
right.
it's kind of, there's an old legal adage that you shouldn't be able to do something indirectly, that you can't do directly. You know, you can't circumvent a rule to accomplish the same goal. And I think it's called a subterfuge. You know, that's what's concerned me about it. But you know, I don't want to be self-righteous here, but that's, when you unveil it, that's how a lot of it's going to be used. Was there anything else in there, Rico? We got a few minutes left. I think
we got a few minutes left.
We're going to have to organize to fight this $2 million insurance requirement. I don't think anything's going to happen on it this session, but boy, by the next session of Congress, we got to go to it.
Tommy Rook, last week's show, was saying it'll never fly because the vast majority, and Rico, maybe you remember the number, it was like 97% or something of truck crashes have, the claims are under, well under $750,000.
They're under the $750,000. The same
right.
thing that the newsletter that David Owen sent out you know, kind of educating everybody about how the majority of the crashes or accidents don't even come up to that threshold. So,
I would be the last one to disagree with Tommy. I think that is the strongest argument for the $1 million being the limit. I think another thing that's an argument for it is to point out that if you're run over by somebody who's operating in intrastate commerce only, all you got's $300,000. If you're there's so many loopholes in even the million that it's an extreme amount for a commercial motor carrier. But reason is not the motivating factor here. The $2 million. Is being underwritten by plaintiffs bar, and the fear of it is 12 of the largest carriers 2 years ago had a thing called the Alliance, and they were arguing for $2 million for everybody, saying that there was an unlevel playing field, that they had deep pockets, so they were getting sued and they were the ones that were paying the $40 million settlement. Two Truck Charlie just folded his tent at $1 million, so that, you know, to satisfy plaintiff's bar, everybody need to be at $2 million. My concern is not the rationale. The rationale is self-supporting. It would be terrible for industry. It's really unnecessary. It's just going to keep Morgan and Morgan happy. But unless we make the case to congressmen, the plaintiff's bar has got a whole bunch of money to throw around. And right. And with AOC and the other politicals we have down here, all you got to do is listen to the ads. We get you what you need.
Right.
Big trucks ran over.
Right.
We live in an emotional world down here.
One
not
call
where they listen
all.
To reason. Yeah, well, you
that's
know,
right.
And what the plaintiff's bar says is, you come to us and we get you twice the judgment. Well, the reason they get twice the judgment is because they hold out the future of litigating. It goes without saying that before a case goes to trial, if I'm RICO's in-house representative, I'm going to go to his insurance company and I'm going to say, I'll do everything we can to help you beat this. This guy's only got a stump toe and he wasn't responsible for the accident. But you know, this is the demand. Unless you pay up to policy limits, if we get a bad jury and they come in with a $40 million judgment, the burden of non-persuasion is on the insurance company. Now, that demand, that defense demand, is what gets the defense attorney hired by the insurance company to have weak knees. He doesn't want to he'll then go tell the insurance company, well, you know, this judge is notorious for letting things in. We don't get very sympathetic juries in Wilson County, Tennessee. It's your decision to make. It's the reason that the insurance that the small carrier has on file often becomes the demand for settlement. And one of the reasons that most of the small cases settle for less of that is it's a bad case, or you know, there's no death, there's no sympathetic
right.
Victim. My concern is if it goes to $2 million, you'll see that past evidence showing that all
right.
those things are settled for under $1 million. It'll now be somewhere between $1 million and two. And you know,
right.
I'm sure Tommy told you the same thing that others have, which is small carriers will see their insurance rates double.
Oh yeah,
right,
definitely. Somebody's going to have to pay for
it. I'm looking at the time. We have blown completely through the hour.
Wow.
It happens every time when we have you on, Hank. It's just a blast.
Give them
remind
my phone
everybody,
number. If anybody had something they want
to
ask me, tell them to give me a call.
That's what I'm fixing to do. If anybody wants to get a hold of Hank, and if you don't have his book on your bookshelf, you are doing yourself a disservice. You can get all of those things over on Hank's website, transportationlaw.net. There's tons and tons of information over there on the website as well, but you have to have that book on your bookshelf. I highly recommend it. You won't spend any better money. It'll keep you it'll keep you out of the weeds and keep your grass cut low so you can see where the snakes are coming from. So with that being said, I'm gonna turn it over to my co-host, Mr. Chuck Snow. Tell them how they can get in contact with you.
They can call me at 800-388-4352. My extension is 203. Going to need that. Or reach me on email. Very easy. chuck@traffix.com. Or just private message me on Instagram, Chuck Snow CEO. And I highly recommend if you ever get into trouble, Hank has got me out of trouble more times than I want to think about. and I thank him for that. So, and I'm not the only client of Hank's that thinks, you know, and talks that way. He's a incredible lawyer, and he's got a great team around him.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
So we want to thank you guys. We want to thank you guys, the listeners, for tuning in tonight, and everybody that may be downloading and listening in the future. Tell a friend to tell a friend about the podcast. You could have been anywhere else in the world, but you took a little time to spend with us, and we definitely appreciate it. And with that being said, we'll talk to you guys same time, same place next week. God bless you and good night. Stay safe, stay healthy, keep it in between the mustard and the mayonnaise.
Bye-bye.
Catch you on the flip-flop. Bye-bye.